Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Abilities.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the November 30th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19, State's Fifth Wave Slows by Meg Wingerder and Sam Tabachnik. Omicron, Who? Variant Poses Very High Risk by Jamie Keaton, Raf Kassert, and Mary Yamaguchi. Johnson and Wales, A Second Life for Campus by Joe Rubino. Barbados Bids Farewell to British Monarchy Becomes Republic by Danica Cotto. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19, State's Fifth Wave Slows. Impact of Omicron Thanksgiving Still Remains to Be Seen by Meg Wingerder and Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. Colorado's fifth COVID-19 wave may be starting to recede, but it's too early to know whether spread over the Thanksgiving holiday or the concerning new Omicron variant will stall or reverse the progress. The number of hospitalizations for confirmed COVID-19 across the state dropped to 1,473 as of Monday afternoon, from a high of 1,576 on November 23rd. Hospitals are still running near capacity, but the state reported more than 100 beds were available in intensive care units for the first time in about 3 weeks. Still, Colorado's public health leaders are prepping in case those downward trends don't continue. A group of experts advising the governor on Monday evening unanimously approved an amended document outlining what the state's crisis standards of care would look like in the event hospitals are completely full and need to ration health care. We do want to have these revised recommendations approved, not because there's any immediate need to activate them, but to have them prepared if the need arises in the coming weeks, said Dr. Eric France, Colorado's chief medical officer. While some people delay seeking medical care over a holiday, Colorado's new COVID-19 hospital admissions started to decline before Thanksgiving, suggesting the state may have passed a peak, said Beth Carlton, associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health. New COVID-19 infections have been trending down, and a lower percentage of tests are coming back positive, though the picture may be partly skewed by lower than usual testing over the last few days, she said. There's some hopeful news there, she said. Still, the virus remains widespread in Colorado, and saying the situation is improving isn't the same as saying it's safe to throw away your masks and forget about scheduling that booster appointment, Carlton said. The risk of encountering someone with SARS-CoV-2 is still high, she said. Two big unknowns remain. What effect, if any, recent holiday gatherings will have on the virus's trajectory, and whether the recently discovered Omicron variant of the virus, not yet confirmed in Colorado, will spark a new wave of cases. Last year, the third wave peaked in late November, and any effects from Thanksgiving were minimal, Carlton said. Of course, the situation is different this year. More people traveled, but fewer are susceptible to severe disease, with so many having been vaccinated. We need a more general approach. During Monday's meeting of the governor's expert emergency epidemic response committee, public health experts explained how the state would expand guidance to hospitals in need of relieving strain in the event they become overwhelmed with patients. The guidelines adopted last year for crisis situations dealt mainly with how to parcel out life-saving ventilators and ICU beds. The new guidance, which awaits review from the governor, takes into account other factors critical to hospitals' capacity for care, including emergency room capacity and non-ICU hospital beds, along with staffing shortages, dialysis, and medication. It became clear that we needed a more general approach, said Dr. Stephen Cantrell, an emergency medicine physician at Denver Health, of the shift from focusing on ventilator availability. The new guidelines focus on the lowest risk patients and how hospitals might be able to erase strain by identifying people, particularly non-COVID-19 patients, who might be able to be discharged earlier than normal to receive outpatient care. These patients can always return to the hospital if needed. The perfect system is not that none of them come back to the hospital, said Dr. Anuj Mehta, a pulmonary critical care physician at Denver Health, who outlined the updated document Monday. If two or three come back, that's a win. The Omicron variant hasn't been found in the United States yet, but Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease doctor, said it almost certainly will be. He urged preparations like increasing testing capacity and wearing masks again. On Sunday, the World Health Organization issued a warning that Omicron has a large number of mutations that could allow it to spread more easily or make it harder for the immune system to recognize that this is a virus it has seen before and should attack. It will take 2 or 3 weeks to get enough data to understand how much we should worry about the new variant, though, Carlton said. The United States, along with other countries, restricted travel from southern Africa, but it's not clear if those measures will be effective since the variant already has spread. Omicron was first identified in South Africa, but it has been found in 11 European countries, Israel, Australia, Canada, Hong Kong, and Botswana. Keeping an eye out for Omicron. In Colorado, essentially all virus samples chosen for genome sequencing have contained the Delta variant. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's lab and some private lab sequence a random sample of positive COVID-19 tests in the state each week. The State Department reported it will update its wastewater surveillance program to look for Omicron. Testing wastewater can't tell the state who has the virus. The sample is tested after many households and businesses' toilet waste has come together. And about half of infected people don't shed virus particles in their stool, but it can give a rough idea of how widespread the virus may be and which variants are circulating. If a community's wastewater has a high viral load, the state can send testing and other resources there to try to get the spread under control. New variants of the virus are expected to occur. Vaccines are the safest, most effective way to slow the spread of COVID-19 and its variants, as well as help avoid the worst outcomes, severe illness, hospitalization, and death, among those who do become infected, a health department spokesperson said. Most variants of SARS-CoV-2 come and go without making any real impact. The exceptions are Alpha, which was first detected in the United Kingdom and became the dominant variant in the world for months because it was more contagious than other types, and Delta, which was first found in India and dethroned Alpha because it spread even more easily. Since Delta already pushed health systems in Colorado and around the country to the breaking point, a more contagious version of the virus would be an additional challenge. It's possible that public health recommendations could change as we learn more about Omicron and any future variants, Carlton said. But for now, people need to keep doing the same things they would to avoid Delta, getting vaccinated or getting a booster if enough time has passed, wearing masks in indoor public spaces, and avoiding crowds when possible. The same tools we've been using for months are the most important ones to use right now, she said. Omicron, WHO, variant poses very high risk, by Jamie Keaton, Raph Kassert, and Mari Yamaguchi, the Associated Press, Byline, Geneva. The World Health Organization warned Monday that the global risk from the Omicron variant is very high, based on the early evidence. saying the mutated coronavirus could lead to surges with severe consequences. The assessment from the UN Health Agency, contained in a technical paper issued to member states, amounted to WHO's strongest, most explicit warning yet about the new version that was first identified days ago by researchers in South Africa. It came as a widening circle of countries around the world reported cases of the variant and moved to slam their doors in an act now, ask questions later approach, while scientists race to figure out just how dangerous the mutant version might be. Japan announced it is barring entry to all foreign visitors, joining Israel in doing so. Morocco banned all incoming flights. Other countries, including the U.S. and members of the European Union, have moved to prohibit travelers arriving from southern Africa. WHO said there are considerable uncertainties about the Omicron variant, but it said preliminary evidence raises the possibility that the variant has mutations that could help it both evade an immune system response and boost its ability to spread from one person to another. Depending on these characteristics, there could be future surges of COVID-19, which could have severe consequences depending on a number of factors, including where surges may take place, it added. The overall global risk is assessed as very high. The WHO stressed that while scientists are hunting evidence to better understand this variant, countries should accelerate vaccinations as quickly as possible. While no deaths linked to Omicron have been reported so far, little is known for certain about the variant, including whether it is more contagious, more likely to cause serious illness, or more able to evade vaccines. Last week, a WHO advisory panel said it might be more likely to reinfect people who have already had a bout with COVID-19. Scientists have long warned that the virus will keep finding new ways to exploit weaknesses in the world's vaccination drive. And its discovery in Africa occurred in a continent where under 7% of the population is vaccinated. The emergence of the Omicron variant has fulfilled in a precise way the predictions of the scientists who warned that the elevated transmission of the virus in areas with limited access to vaccine would speed its evolution, said Dr. Richard Hatchett, head of CEPI, one of the founders of the UN-backed global vaccine sharing initiative, COVAX. Spain on Monday became one of the latest countries to report its first confirmed Omicron case, detected in a traveler who returned Sunday from South Africa after making a stopover in Amsterdam. While a majority of Omicron infections recorded around the world have been in travelers arriving from abroad, cases in Portugal and Scotland have raised fears that the variant may already be spreading locally. Many of us might think we are done with COVID-19. It's not done with us, warned Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who's director general. The Omicron infections have underscored the difficulty in keeping the virus in check in a globalized world of jet travel and open borders. Yet many countries are trying to do just that, against the urging of the WHO, which noted that border closings often have limited effect and can wreak havoc on lives and livelihoods. Despite the global worry, doctors in South Africa are reporting patients are suffering mostly mild symptoms so far, but they warned that it is early. Johnson and Wales, a second life for campus, project by new owners to transform 25-acre property in northeast Denver, underway, by Joe Rubino, The Denver Post. 5 months after Denver Public Schools, the Denver Housing Authority, and nonprofit Urban Land Conservancy teamed to buy the 25-acre Johnson and Wells University property in northeast Denver, change is starting. A pair of affordable housing projects are in the planning stages for the former dorm buildings on the property, located at 7150 Montview Boulevard. A major expansion of the Denver School of the Arts on the campus's west side also is on deck. The project is expected to allow the school to grow by between 500 and 700 students and prioritize students of color and low-income families, officials said, when the sale closed in June. The work follows pledges from Johnson & Wales representatives last year that the university would prioritize buyers dedicated to supporting the surrounding neighborhood. Even before construction crews get started on those projects, new public benefits are starting on the historic property. Jorge de la Torre, formerly the dean of the culinary program at Johnson & Wales, joined nonprofit Shared Kitchen and Food Business Incubator Kitchen Network when that organization opened a location on the campus this summer. Kitchen Network, in turn, brought in organizations including Work Options, a nonprofit job training program focused on helping people with criminal records and those who are homeless develop kitchen skills, and starting an apprenticeship program with the Rocky Mountain Chefs of Colorado. Partnerships with more than a half dozen other nonprofits and local restaurant companies are also in place, and a 24-hour commissary kitchen is expected to open on the campus early next year, De La Torre said. The silver lining is the campus just gets a second life to be available to people who may not have been able to afford a Johnson & Wales education, he said. We can just reach a larger population. Eric Garcia, Kitchen Network's chief operating officer, said the nonprofit has 150 monthly active users and helped launch more than 60 new businesses this year, as of November. With its Park Hill location, Garcia hopes to triple those numbers over the next 5 years, reaching a new well of clients on the east side of the city, many of them Spanish-speaking. Across from the Culinary Arts Building, the campus's historic Centennial Hall is providing St. Elizabeth School with room to grow. The K-8 private Episcopal school, with 140 students, now has the space to double in size, Director of Finance and Operations Kim Johnson said. Part of the school's mission is to be intentionally inclusive. Its student body is 49% students of color, and 83% of students get discounted tuition. School leadership saw the Park Hill campus as an opportunity to work alongside organizations with similar values and goals, Johnson said. Preserving history, providing opportunity. Centennial Hall was completed in 1908, when the campus debuted as Colorado Women's College, according to Historic Denver. It and the other buildings are part of the landscape and the culture of the greater Park Hill area, said Denver City Councilwoman Robin Nietzsche, who lives about a mile from the campus. Seeing DPS, the Housing Authority, and the Urban Land Conservancy come together and to be able to pull off the acquisition was both a pleasant surprise and very reassuring, she said. On the opposite side of Denver, for-profit development firm Westside Investment Partners is also working on historic reuse and affordable housing projects at the former Loretto Heights College campus on Federal Boulevard, but Nietzsche said that the city had to push for affordability there. In Park Hill, creating affordable housing is a core mission of two of the new owners. I believe that our Park Hill community recognizes the importance of being able to bring together preservation of historic buildings and preservation of affordable housing options in our city, Nietzsche said. Focus on housing. It may be a while before people can move into the planned affordable apartments. The Denver Housing Authority views the two dorm buildings it acquired on the property's south side as an opportunity for really quick housing, spokeswoman Keo Frazier said. Some of the 72 units already have kitchens and private bathrooms, but work is needed and the agency is focused on preserving the historic elements of the building. The agency doesn't have a timeline for when it expects to open, Frazier said. Nonprofit developer Archway Communities cleared an important hurdle earlier this month in its efforts to transform about 400 dorm rooms on the northeast side of the campus into affordable apartments. The Colorado Housing and Finance Authority awarded the project a combined $2.9 million in competitive state and federal tax credits to help fund the work. Archway plans to tap into historic preservation tax credits and other financing for what is expected to be a roughly $45 million project President and CEO Sebastian Corradino said. When work is completed, ideally sometime in early 2024, the four buildings archway is under contract to buy from the Urban Land Conservancy will be turned into more than 150 subsidized apartments, at least 10 of which will be available to families making 30% or less of the area median income. Using 2021 income figures, it would cap the rent for a three-bedroom apartment at $817 a month for qualified low-income families. Urban Land Conservancy has urged Archway to build more two- and three-bedroom apartments in the project than it normally would, which speaks to the nonprofit's commitment to serving working families in nearby neighborhoods, Corradino said. Loan fund was key. During a recent walk through the property, Urban Land Conservancy CEO Aaron Mirapol said he never thought the nonprofit would buy a whole university campus. A lot of things had to go right. There was a willing seller in Johnson & Wales. Then DPS first expressed interest in the campus and reached out to Urban Land Conservancy about making an offer. The school district put up $30 million of the $62.2 million needed to close the deal, according to the Conservancy. An important part of the story was the large pot of money at Urban Land Conservancy's fingertips that allowed it to make a move within weeks and keep up with the commercial developers trying to acquire the property, Mirapol said. The Conservancy is the sole borrower with access to the Metro Denver Impact Facility, a low-interest loan fund seeded with $25 million from First Bank in 2018. With support from junior lenders, including Gates Family Foundation and the Colorado Health Foundation, the fund grew to $50 million and allowed the nonprofit to make 9 purchases, preserving affordable space for nonprofits, schools, and housing. In the Johnson & Wales deal, $19.5 million came from that fund. I think it shows that the nonprofit sector can do these types of things, Mirapol said. Mirapol is hopeful that the Metro Denver Impact Facility will grow in the future to make more large-scale purchases like the Johnson & Wales purchase possible. Amber Hills, First Bank's president for the Southwest Market, wrote in an email that First Bank shares Aaron's aspirations that this fund will reach $75 million. Urban Land Conservancy Vice President Aaron Clark is still working on legal frameworks and permits for the campus. But in September, she and others involved in the complicated purchase were able to sit back and enjoy a 1,000-person block party on the property, something Clark said Urban Land Conservancy hopes to host every year. The Conservancy has other ideas in mind, including a farmers market on the quad, free live performances from DSA students, and other activities designed to invite neighbors onto the grounds, Clark said. One of the next big steps in integrating with Greater Park Hill is renaming the campus. A consultant is gathering input for that. This is about preservation of buildings, preservation of open space, but also the preservation of a feeling within a community and preservation of opportunity, Clark said. Barbados bids farewell to British monarchy, becomes republic, by Danica Cotto, byline San Juan, Puerto Rico. Barbados stopped pledging allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II on Tuesday as it shed another vestige of its colonial past and became a republic for the first time in history. Several leaders, dignitaries, and artists, including Prince Charles and Rihanna, attended the ceremony that began late Monday in a popular square where the statue of a well-known British lord was removed last year, amid a worldwide push to erase symbols of oppression. Fireworks peppered the sky at midnight as Barbados officially became a republic, with screens set up across the island so people could watch the event that featured an orchestra with more than 100 steel pan players and numerous singers, poets, and dancers. It was also broadcast online, prompting a flurry of excited messages from Bajans living in the U.S., Canada, and beyond. "Happy Independence Day and freedom to all," wrote one viewer. The drive to become a republic began more than two decades ago and culminated with the island's parliament electing its first ever president last month in a two-thirds majority vote. Barbados Governor General Sandra Mason was sworn in before dawn on Tuesday as the island marked its 55th anniversary of independence from Britain. As cautioned by our first prime minister, we ought no longer to be found loitering on colonial premises, she said. We must seek to redefine our definition of self, of state, and the Barbados brand in a more complex, fractured, and turbulent world. Our country and people must dream big dreams and fight to realize them. Mason, 72, is an attorney and judge who also has served as ambassador to Venezuela, Colombia, Chile, and Brazil. She will help Prime Minister Mia Motley lead the wealthy Caribbean island of more than 300,000 people that is dependent on tourism, manufacturing, and finance. Barbados didn't need permission from the UK to become a republic, although the island will remain a member of the Commonwealth realm. It's an event that the Caribbean hasn't experienced since the 1970s, when Guyana, Dominica, and Trinidad and Tobago became republics. Barbados became independent from the United Kingdom in November 1966, more than three centuries after English settlers arrived and turned the island into a wealthy sugar colony based on the work of hundreds of thousands of African slaves. In recent decades, the island has begun distancing itself from its colonial past. In 2005, Barbados dropped the London-based Privy Council and chose the Trinidad-based Caribbean Court of Justice as its final court of appeal. Then in 2008, it proposed a referendum on the issue of becoming a republic, but it was pushed back indefinitely. Last year, Barbados announced plans to stop being a constitutional monarchy and removed a statue of British Vice Admiral Horatio Nelson from National Heroes Square, the location of the event to celebrate becoming a republic. From the darkest days of our past and the appalling atrocity of slavery, which forever stains our history, the people of this island forged their path with extraordinary fortitude, said Prince Charles, who thanked Barbadian officials for inviting him and said he has greatly admired what they've achieved. Freedom, justice, and self-determination have been your guides. During the ceremony, the Prime Minister awarded pop star Rihanna the honor of National Hero of Barbados, telling her, "May you continue to shine like a diamond," as they both laughed. Barbados's flag, coat of arms, and national anthem will remain the same, but certain references will change, according to Suleiman Bulbulia, a columnist for the Barbados Today newspaper. He wrote that the terms royal and crown will no longer be used, so the Royal Barbados Police Force will become the Barbados Police Service, and crown lands will become state lands. "It is the beginning of a new era," he wrote. "Any Barbadian can aspire now to be our head of state." Brighton. Probe of councilman stems from alleged DUI incident by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. An investigation launched last week by the city of Brighton into the conduct of Councilman Chris Giordanelli stemmed from an incident in August in which police say Giordanelli drove drunk to a city council meeting and, when later questioned at his home, identified himself as an elected official and told the officer, "You don't want to mess with me." The August 17th incident is outlined in a 12-page police report obtained by the Denver Post. Giordanelli, who was elected to the council in November 2019, was charged with misdemeanor DUI. The case is scheduled for a February 7th hearing in Adams County. The city's investigation, for which the law firm of Wilson Williams LLP was hired as a special prosecutor, is limited to looking into whether Giordanelli's alleged statement to police broke any ethical standards or municipal laws. The city is paying the firm $250 an hour for its work. The decision by city council last week to appoint the firm to look into the matter was unanimous. Giordanelli was absent for the vote. The police report states that Giordanelli, 64, arrived for the meeting disheveled, in shorts and a polo shirt, and was walking with an unsteady gait. Several officers described a strong smell of alcohol in his breath, and video surveillance later obtained by police showed that Giordinelli had driven to City Hall right before the meeting and parked his Buick at an angle occupying two parking spaces. After being escorted downstairs by a fellow councilman from a hallway outside council chambers, Giordinelli was walked to his nearby home by two city staff members, the report said. When police contacted him at home to ask him about his car being at City Hall, they described Giordinelli as having red, watery eyes, slurred speech, and being unsteady on his feet. In the report, police said Giordinelli opened his garage door in an apparent effort to show officers that his car was at home. The garage was empty. Giordinelli, according to the report, then asked the officers if they knew who he was. After informing the officers that he was a city councilman, he said, "You don't want to mess with me." Giordinelli on Monday said the case arises out of my suffering a serious medical event prior to a meeting and one of my political opponents trying to use that event now, several months after it occurred, to try to oust me from office. I am sad to see how low others have gone to try and get rid of me just because we may not agree on political issues, he said in an email. I look forward to being vindicated of this baseless charge in court. He did not identify who his political opponents are. Giordinelli was chastised by his colleagues on the council last year. During a September 2020 virtual council meeting, he delivered an incoherent rant, after which he was censured by the council. They said his conduct was inconsistent with the values and ideals of the council or the city of Brighton. Giordinelli attributed his behavior during that meeting to being under the influence of alcohol and medication and apologized. Mayor Gregory Mills on Monday declined to comment on the current case, citing an active investigation. Councilman Adam Cushing told the Denver Post that Giordinelli's alleged statement to police was deeply concerning to me. There is no special privilege granted to elected officials in Brighton, and in my opinion, quite the opposite, he said. We should be held to a high standard and should encourage and support efforts from our law enforcement to investigate any possible violations of the law, especially when it involves an elected official. Aurora teen killed in shooting with former police officer identified by Jake Shapiro. The Denver Post. The teenage boy killed in gunfire during an exchange with a former local police officer has been identified by his family. Peyton Blitzstein, 17, was shot during a November 24th incident outside of an Aurora home. The Aurora Police Department sent officers to the 4900 block of South Addison Way around 10:30 p.m. the night before Thanksgiving. The area is close to the intersection of South Gun Club Road and East Bellevue Avenue. Police said that the teen was killed following an exchange of gunfire with a 36-year-old man, a former Greenwood Village police officer. The officer was identified by Denver 7 as Adam Holen, an officer since 2016 until a recent resignation at the beginning of November. Holen was also shot, but is expected to survive, police said. In a doorbell camera video obtained by Denver 7, the two parties argue over alleged careless driving through the neighborhood before shots were fired. A group of teens were going back and forth between parked cars during the confrontation. After shots were fired, Holen appears to briefly leave the scene as two people attempt to aid Blitzstein. A GoFundMe set up to help Blitzstein's family with expenses, says a 17-year-old was a loving son, nephew, and grandson. He was an amazing young man, joining the young Marines and the Sea Cadets, the GoFundMe reads. His favorite things to do were to watch the Hallmark Channel with his grandmother. He was fascinated by his Osage Nation heritage and was the ultimate homebody, playing video games upstairs in his robe and slippers. This loss has been devastating to the family, and we only pray that he is at peace, feeling unconditional love. No charges have been filed relating to the shooting. DA, officers justified in fatal shooting. Three Westminster police officers will not face criminal charges after shooting and killing a man in September who, authorities allege, fired at law enforcement during an attempted arrest. Denver District Attorney Beth McCann determined the three officers, Anthony Straub, Chris Neal, and Kevin Flores were justified in shooting 37-year-old Drew Lucero on September 3rd at a house in Denver's Montbello neighborhood. Once Mr. Lucero exited the house, produced a weapon, and fired it, it was impossible for these officers to apply nonviolent means prior to resorting to physical force, Denver District Attorney Beth McCann said in a news release announcing her decision. Lucero had a warrant out for his arrest on a host of charges, including attempted murder, in connection with a 2020 incident in which he allegedly shot a woman during a domestic violence incident, McCann said in the decision letter. Police were looking for Lucero on September 3rd after he caused damage to the same victim's house, authorities said. As police attempted to arrest Lucero at the end of a driveway, Lucero allegedly pulled out a semi-automatic handgun and fired one round in the direction of two of the officers, prosecutors said. Lucero pointed his gun at officers again, at which point they opened fire, McCann wrote. He died at the hospital later that night. This is from Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Man stabbed to death in Westminster. Jefferson County authorities are investigating a homicide after a man was found stabbed to death early Monday inside a Westminster home. Sheriff's deputies responded at 4 a.m. to the 10,400 block of Ammons Street to reports of a break-in, and upon arrival found the unidentified man dead, the sheriff's office said in a news release. A witness who lives at the house told police that the male had forced entry into the home and was stabbed by another female resident during a physical altercation between the male and the witness, authorities said in the release. The residents knew the man, the sheriff's office said, and investigators are interviewing the individuals involved. This is from Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Video fallout. Congresswoman hangs up on Boebert during apology call, by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Republican U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert said in a video on Monday that she called Democratic U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar to apologize for implying that the Muslim congresswoman could be a suicide bomber. But the call didn't go as planned, and ultimately Omar, who represents Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, which includes Minneapolis, hung up. Instead of apologizing for her Islamophobic comments and fabricated lies, Representative Boebert refused to publicly acknowledge her hurtful and dangerous comments, Omar said in a statement. She instead doubled down on her rhetoric, and I decided to end the unproductive call. The conflagration began last week after a video spread on Twitter of Boebert telling a small group a story about running into Omar on an elevator. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine, Boebert said, later calling Omar a member of the, quote, jihad squad, unquote. In her statement, Omar said the elevator tale was false. Boebert tweeted an apology for the remarks on Friday to anyone in the Muslim community I offended, and followed up with a video outlining her call with Omar on Monday. I wanted to let Omar know directly that I had reflected on my previous remarks, Boebert said. As a strong Christian woman who values faith deeply, I never want anything I say to offend someone's religion, so I told her that. She said that she still wanted a public apology because what I had done wasn't good enough, Boebert continued. She kept asking for a public apology, so I told Ilhan Omar that she should make a public apology to the American people for her anti-American, anti-Semitic, and anti-police rhetoric. Omar then hung up, Boebert said, adding that rejecting an apology and hanging up on someone is part of cancel culture 101. I will continue to fearlessly put America first, never sympathizing with terrorists, Boebert added. Unfortunately, Ilhan can't say the same thing, and our country is worse off for it. Omar, however, noted that Republican leaders remain silent on Boebert's actions and have not condemned her repeated anti-Muslim comments. I believe in engaging with those we disagree with respectively, but not when that disagreement is rooted in outright bigotry and hate, Omar said. Boebert's refusal to apologize during the belligerent call and doubling down by accusing Omar of sympathizing with terrorists should earn the Western Slope Congresswoman a censure from her colleagues, according to Robert McCaw, Director of Government Affairs for the Council on American Islamic Relations. Makah called Boebert's latest remarks a disgusting new low and called for Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy to condemn them and demand a public apology from her. McCarthy released a statement on Saturday, but did not denounce what Boebert said. If Boebert still refuses to apologize, McCarthy said Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and House Democratic Majority Leader Steny Hoyer should move to censure her. Failing to do so would signal that Islamophobia is an acceptable form of bigotry in the halls of Congress, McCarthy said. Dozens killed in Syria. Pentagon chief orders inquiry into airstrike by Eric Schmidt, the New York Times Company. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin III on Monday ordered a new high-level investigation into a U.S. airstrike in Syria in 2019 that killed dozens of women and children, according to a senior Defense Department official. The investigation by General Michael Garrett, the four-star head of the Army's Forces Command, will examine the strike, which was carried out by a shadowy, classified special operations unit called Task Force 9, as well as the handling of the task force investigation by higher military headquarters and the Defense Department's Inspector General, the official said. Garrett will have 90 days to review inquiries already conducted into the episode and further investigate reports of civilian casualties, whether any violations of laws of war occurred, record-keeping errors, whether any recommendations from earlier reviews were carried out, and whether anyone should be held accountable, said the official, who spoke on condition of anonymity because the investigation had not been announced. He announced the inquiry after the Defense Department notified Congress. The House and Senate Armed Services Committees have both said that they are investigating the strike. Austin's decision comes in the wake of a New York Times investigation this month that described allegations that top officers and civilian officials had sought to conceal the casualties. The Syria airstrike took place near the town of Baghouz on March 18, 2019. As part of the final battle against Islamic State fighters in a shard of a once sprawling religious state across Iraq and Syria. It was among the largest episodes of civilian casualties in the years-long war against the Islamic State group, but the U.S. military had never publicly acknowledged it. The classified task force investigated the strike and acknowledged that four civilians were killed, but it also concluded that there had been no wrongdoing by the Special Operations Unit. In October 2019, the task force sent its findings to the Central Command headquarters in Tampa, Florida. But officials at Central Command did not follow up and failed to remind a subordinate military headquarters in Baghdad to do so, in what Captain Bill Urban, a Central Command spokesperson, described as an administrative oversight. As a result, senior military officials in Iraq and Florida never reviewed the strike, and the investigation technically remained open until the Times investigation. Austin, who became defense secretary this year, received a classified briefing this month about the strike and the military's handling of it from General Kenneth McKenzie Jr., head of Central Command. The Times investigation showed that the death toll from the strike, 80 people, was almost immediately apparent to military officials, but the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. Capitol riot. Panel sets contempt vote for former DOJ official. By Mary Claire Jelonek, The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. A House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection will vote Wednesday to hold a former Justice Department official in contempt, demanding criminal charges against a defiant witness for a second time as lawmakers seek answers about the violent attack. The committee on Monday scheduled a vote to pursue contempt charges against Jeffrey Clark, a former Justice Department lawyer who aligned with President Donald Trump as he tried to overturn his election defeat. If approved by the panel, the recommendation of criminal contempt charges would then go to the full House for a vote and then to the Justice Department. Clark appeared for a deposition November 5th, but told lawmakers that he would not answer questions based partly on Trump's legal efforts to block the committee's investigation. The vote will come as the panel is also considering contempt charges against former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who was Trump's top aide the day that hundreds of his supporters violently attacked the U.S. Capitol and interrupted the certification of President Joe Biden's victory. Meadows was subpoenaed in September, but has not yet sat for an interview with the committee. The panel has vowed to aggressively seek charges against any witness who doesn't comply as they investigate the worst attack on the Capitol in two centuries, and the Justice Department has signaled it is willing to pursue those charges, indicting longtime Trump ally Steve Bannon earlier this month on two federal counts of criminal contempt. Attorney General Merrick Garland said then that Bannon's indictment reflects the department's steadfast commitment to the rule of law after Bannon outright defied the committee and refused to cooperate. Clark's case could be more complicated since he did appear for his deposition and, unlike Bannon, was a Trump administration official on January 6. Trump has sued to block the committee's work and has attempted to assert executive privilege or documents and interviews, arguing that his conversations and actions at the time should be shielded from public view. A report issued by Democrats on the Senate's Judiciary Committee detailed how Clark championed Trump's efforts to undo the election results and clashed as a result with Justice Department superiors who resisted the pressure, culminating in a dramatic White House meeting at which Trump ruminated about elevating Clark to Attorney General. He did not do so after several aides threatened to resign. In a somewhat similar case, the Justice Department in 2015 declined to prosecute former IRS official Lois Lerner on contempt of Congress charges after Lerner delivered an opening statement at a hearing but then repeatedly declined to answer questions from lawmakers, citing her Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate herself. This time, though, the Justice Department is considering the charges against a former administration official, not a current official. With little precedent to go on, it's unclear what the department would do. In news briefs, Biden vaccine rule blocked in 10 states. Byline, Jefferson City, Missouri. A federal judge on Monday blocked President Joe Biden's administration from enforcing a coronavirus vaccine mandate on thousands of healthcare workers in 10 states that had brought the first legal challenge against the requirement. The court order said that the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid had no clear authority from Congress to enact the vaccine mandate for providers participating in the two government healthcare programs for older people, the disabled, and the poor. The preliminary injunction by St. Louis-based U.S. District Judge Matthew Shelp applies to a coalition of suing states that includes Alaska, Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, New Hampshire, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. All those states have either a Republican attorney general or governor. The federal rule requires COVID-19 vaccinations for more than 17 million workers nationwide in about 76,000 healthcare facilities and home healthcare providers that get funding from the government health programs. Workers are to receive their first dose by December 6th and their second shot by January 4th. Court denies hospital workers' vaccine appeal. Byline, Washington. The Supreme Court turned away an emergency appeal from employees at the largest hospital system in Massachusetts who object to the COVID-19 vaccine on religious grounds. Justice Stephen Breyer did not comment Monday in rejecting the request from employees at Mass General Brigham for a religious exemption to the system's vaccine requirement. Lawyers for the employees said in court papers that six have been fired, one has resigned, and another was vaccinated in order to remain employed. Bill Cosby prosecutors ask U.S. Supreme Court to review case. Byline, Philadelphia. Prosecutors asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review the ruling that overturned Bill Cosby's sexual assault conviction, arguing in a petition Monday that a dangerous precedent could be set if press releases are treated as immunity agreements. Cosby's lawyers have argued that he relied on a promise that he would never be charged when he gave damaging testimony in an accuser's civil suit in 2006. The admissions were later used against him in two criminal trials. The only written evidence of such a promise is a 2005 press release from the then prosecutor, Bruce Castor, who said he did not have enough evidence to arrest Cosby. Prosecutors add sixth homicide count in Wisconsin parade crash. Byline, Waukesha. Prosecutors added a sixth intentional homicide count Monday against a Wisconsin man accused of driving his SUV through a Christmas parade in suburban Milwaukee. Investigators allege Daryl Brooks Jr., 39, turned into the parade route in Waukesha on November 21st and struck dozens of people. Authorities announced later that night that five people had died. An 8-year-old boy died 2 days later. These reports were from Denver Post Wire reports. Nuclear deal. Iran wants sanctions lifted immediately. By Stephen Erlinger, The New York Times Company, byline Vienna. The setting was right, but the atmosphere chilly. After a break of more than 5 months, talks on reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal resumed on Monday at the Palaz Coburg, the luxury hotel in Vienna where the original pact was signed, with much fanfare, in a more optimistic time. With a more conservative government now in place in Iran, and a new set of Iranian negotiators who have said talks need to start with a complete lifting of sanctions, the mood was somber among Western negotiators. But as the first round of formal discussions ended Monday, negotiators also tried to be upbeat. Enrique Mora of the European Union, who is presiding over the talks, said that Iran recognizes the work done in the past 6 rounds and the fact that we will be building on that. But he said that Iran was insisting on sanctions lifting immediately, which is likely to be unacceptable to Washington. Iran is also insisting that the United States and its allies promise never to impose sanctions on Iran again, the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri Khani, a deputy foreign minister, told reporters after the talks. According to a senior European official who requested anonymity, the Iranian negotiator also said during meetings that Iran would further escalate its nuclear program if those demands were not met. But in an important step to keep the negotiations alive, Iran agreed to resume talks Tuesday in one of 3 working groups established in earlier rounds, on which sanctions would eventually be lifted by the United States. The other 2 working groups, on the nuclear issue itself and on implementation and the sequencing of each country's actions in the event of a new deal, will not resume talks Tuesday. Mora said the nuclear working group would meet Wednesday. There is a sense of urgency to restore the nuclear deal, he said, but there is no fixed timeline in my mind. The Europeans had felt that significant progress in all 3 working groups had been made in the earlier talks, although awkwardly, since Iran refuses to talk directly to the American envoy, Robert Malley, and will do so only through the existing signatories, France, Britain, Germany, China, Russia, and more. The Biden administration has said it wants to return to the original nuclear deal with Iran, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which former President Donald Trump abandoned in 2018, calling it the worst deal in history. The new Iranian government seems to believe the same, with Bagheri Khani repeating in an opinion article in the Financial Times his view that the very term nuclear negotiations is itself rife with error. Iran's first goal, he wrote, is to gain a full, guaranteed, and verifiable removal of the sanctions that have been imposed on the Iranian people. The talks, he said earlier this month, are negotiations to remove unlawful and inhuman sanctions, a theme also struck Monday in an article in the Iranian press by former Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The situation on the ground in Iran has changed in the past 5 months since the last rounds of talks ended, making this week's discussions more difficult. Cuomo Brothers, Chris's off-air role Andrew's Strategist by Michael R. Sisak and Marina Villanueva, The Associated Press, Byline, New York. CNN anchor Chris Cuomo had a bigger role than previously known in helping defend his brother, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, from sexual harassment allegations that forced him out of office, newly released transcripts and text messages show. The TV journalist offered to reach out to sources, including other reporters, to find out whether more women were going to come forward, and relayed what he was hearing to his brother's advisors, according to the materials made public Monday. He also sparred with the former governor's aides over strategy, urging an apologetic tone and critiquing an early statement that he saw as downplaying the allegations. He accused a top aide of hiding information from his brother. Yet Chris Cuomo told investigators he spoke regularly with his brother, coaching him on his response and admonishing him for bad judgment. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We don't know a lot about the variant, except that it is a great concern.
To stem the spread of the Omicron variant, President Joe Biden announced that starting today, the U.S. is restricting travel for non-U.S. citizens from South Africa and seven other countries. Cases of the mutated COVID-19 virus have been confirmed in more than a dozen nations. Biden again encouraged Americans to get vaccinated.
We always talk about whether this is about freedom. I think it's a patriotic responsibility.
Conservatives say Biden accused former President Donald Trump of racism and xenophobia for enacting similar travel bans in 2020. But Dr. Anthony Fauci warned that the variant could create a fifth wave of COVID-19 infections and also brushed off his critics as being anti-science. That includes Kentucky Republican Senator Rand Paul, who again pressed Fauci over his knowledge of gain-of-function research, where a lab intentionally makes a virus more deadly.
You won't admit that it's dangerous, and for that lack of judgment, I think it's time that you resign.
Fauci said no gain-of-function research took place with this virus. Others have called that charge a conspiracy theory. Tomorrow, President Biden heads to Minnesota to promote the recently signed $1.2 trillion infrastructure law. During the Thanksgiving break, many members of Congress touted the benefits of the law back home, including California Democrat Barbara Lee. She told union workers that underinvestment in infrastructure made economic and racial inequality worse.
Too often, the infrastructure that we built created more inequality. This infrastructure law now advances equality, equity, environmental justice, unlike any law that we have ever seen before.
The House is back in session tomorrow. Today, the Senate convenes to work on the National Defense Authorization Act. The Department of Justice is considering a charge of contempt against former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows for ignoring a subpoena from the January 6th Select House Committee. Former Trump strategist Steve Bannon recently pleaded not guilty to contempt of Congress for refusing to appear.
Not just Trump people and not just conservatives. Every progressive and every liberal in this country that likes freedom of speech and liberty, okay, should be fighting for this case.
Bannon, Meadows, and other Trump allies cite executive privilege for their lack of cooperation. The nationwide right to abortion is at the center of a case before the Supreme Court this Wednesday. A Mississippi law bans all abortions after 15 weeks, before fetal viability. Catherine Colbert argued the 1992 Supreme Court case Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which she explains established the right to choose abortion up to viability.
Any restriction that is less than that places the question, is Roe versus Wade still the law of the land, before the court. It is my view that they are going to say no, and they are going to again permit states to ban abortion.
In a recent poll by the Washington Post and ABC, 60% of Americans said they believe the Roe v. Wade decisions should be upheld. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
The Volunteer Senior Peer Counseling Program at Senior Reach of Adams County connects older volunteers with other older adults throughout the country. These volunteer counselors visit clients in their own homes, meet at senior centers, and at other community locations. One of the greatest benefits for participants is knowing they have someone to talk to on an ongoing basis who can offer support and understanding. Senior peer counselors are volunteers with similar life experiences as participants. They go through background checks, orientation, ongoing training, and guidance to offer the best support possible for program participants. They provide a safe, confidential environment to talk about feelings and experiences, empowerment to explore solutions, and direction to community resources. For more information, go to seniorreach.org or contact 303-853-3658 or seniorreach@communityreachcenter.org.